we've worked our way up to this whole idea of divine hardening, right? The Bible consistently indicates that human decision-making proceeds from our thoughts and our intentions. Furthermore, many passages speak of God's looking at the heart when judging a person's character. So God is looking at what we are and how we're making decisions. This indicates that a person retains a significant, Christensen tells us, a significant kind of personal control over his or her inner thoughts and dispositions, and thus responsible for what is generated in the heart. We're responsible for that.
Right.
Right.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why I think Christians picks both Job and what we're going to look at here for divine hardening is because the scripture is really clear, unless you're trying to kind of get around it with, you know, the idea of libertarian free will. But he uses verses in the Job passage and in what will happen here in divine hardening of saying, no, this is what God did. And not only that, we have people saying, this is what God did. And even though with Job, we've kind of torn back the curtain a little bit, seen what happens in the divine realm, and sees that it's Satan and God having this conversation among the sons of men up in the throne room. But no one on earth knows that except for whoever the author of Job ended up being.
Right, and notice he also mentions that Job's wife, Job's brothers and sisters, none of them mention Satan as the source of this evil. They all say it comes from God.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Nor does Job sin when he attributes it to God. His wife does sin when she says, curse God and die.
Yeah.
Right. Probably not the best thing to do.
God is in control, and so curse him and die, not curse Satan for doing this, right?
Yeah. So maybe we can learn something from that Baptist preachers. So many might suppose that this is evidence of libertarian free will, but not so fast. Many other complementary passages indicate that the heart is controlled by God. For example, compare what Solomon writes in Proverbs 21:2. He states, every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the heart. In the previous verse, however, he asserts the king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wills. That's God. God's turning it wherever he wills. Mm. But we all have libertarian free will. God would not interact with us at that level because we need to be free. We need to be able to do what we need to do. And maybe it's just this one time, the Proverbs 21:1 and Ezra 6:22 and 7:27 talk about. There's no contradiction here, though. It merely affirms compatibilism. We are constantly conscious that our hearts belong to us. We have ownership of our inner being and our person. Yet our hearts rest first and foremost in the hands of the ultimate owner of human souls.
Mm. Yeah. So now what is striking, he says, is how many times scripture indicates that God freely hardens the heart of his creatures, right? Romans 9:18, for instance, he has mercy on whomever he wills, and he hardens whomever he will.
Yeah.
Right. Pharaoh is obviously the prime example here of this divine heartening. Exodus, chapters 4-17 records the episode surrounding the plagues of judgment on the Egyptians and the exodus, by the Israelites from enslavement in Egypt.
I mean, with how many plagues occur, with how many times Moses has to come before Pharaoh and say, this is going to happen, and it happens, it's got to be divine hardening.
Yeah, right. So notice, throughout the ordeal, numerous times Pharaoh, though, is said to have hardened his own heart. Right. That's what it says. Right. Numerous times, it says Pharaoh hardened his own heart. Yet prominently, Christensen tells us, interspersed, right, in the same episode, we read that God hardened his heart. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So there's no disparity between Pharaoh's hardening and God's hardening. Pharaoh is secondary, but immediate cause of the hardening. He consciously, willingly, freely generated the stubbornness and his refusal to let God's people go. He wasn't like, oh, all right, I'll let him go. And then suddenly, he sits up straight and starts moving marionette.
You shall not go.
yeah, this isn't God, coming down pulling on the strings there. But at the same time, God is the primary but remote cause of Pharaoh's hardening. Scripture is merely affirming dual or compatibilistic explanation for what is transpiring in The Stubborn Rule is the Heart. And again, right. I have to recommend What About Free Will by Scott Christensen. Who would have thought? Because he, if you're kind of looking for more information, especially on this part too, he talks about that with primary and secondary causes. You can see our interview with him as well to kind of get a good take on that as well.
Yeah. So notice God indicates that all this hardening had a greater good, right? He communicates to Pharaoh, but in early on in Exodus 9, but for this purpose, I have raised you up to show you my power so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. So all this hardening that God did and also that Pharaoh did, uh-huh. right, was for a greater good. The supernatural power invested in the devastating plagues, Christensen tells us, and the glorious exit of the Israelites through the midst of the Red Sea left an indelible impact, not only, you know, on all who witnessed these things, but also in subsequent history.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get to, you know, even when they go to Jericho, right, to destroy Jericho, people are afraid. Why? Well, because of what God did in Egypt, you know, over 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. And so it left an indelible impact.
Right. But even within the conquest narratives, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Medo-Persians, you know, we were reading in Daniel, there is passages, references back to the Exodus. Mm-hmm. It's a staple within the Old Testament and also the New Testament. Mm-hmm. Jesus mentioned it a number of times. Yeah. The apostles mentioned it a number of times in their writings.
The whole Passover meal is about the Exodus, right?
Yeah, it plays a big key point. And look at what it does. It takes out the claims of the Egyptian gods. It takes out the wealth of the Egyptians. It takes out the military of the Egyptians. So this hardening was done so that the kind of complete ruin of any claim of power, well, if Pharaoh would have just done this, or if they would have just had this, or yeah, okay, that they lost their slaves, but they're so powerful that they could have, no, all this was taken away, and they had to, you know, go find other sources to replenish their you know, cows and in the fields and everything like that. Even the Nile itself turns to blood. So it's a complete ruin of Egypt from any source of power might claim that they would do. Yeah. And once Israel becomes a nation, there's a decree by God not to go back to Egypt to get things like chariots and horses and stuff like that, but to rely on God.
And so what we see here is basically a defeat of the Egyptian gods.
Right. Yeah.
The Lord is Lord, and he shows that by what the devastation that he does in Egypt. Idolatry is bad. Idolatry uh-huh. is evil. Idolatry will be punished,
right?
And that's what we see in this account, or at least part of what we see.
And even what starts out as the first initial offering, let us go into the desert, make offering to God, we'll return. It's simple at first, and then once it ramps up, it gets deeper and deeper of, let my people go. We're mm-hmm. done with this. We're going to go away. So much so, as they're leaving, not only are they bringing Egyptian gold out of there, go away, here, take yeah, it,
take
don't come
debt.
Back.
That's
so
right.
You don't ever come back. You have your have gold to buy food or whatnot on the road. But even Egyptians go with them and become part of the people of God.
Yeah.
It's amazing story. Really cool.